give their attention. For the court is now in session.
The clerk of court will please call the case. Called today for continuation of the oral arguments are the consolidated cases on Republic Act number 10175, otherwise known as the Cybercrime Prevention Act of 2012. For brevity, only the GR numbers of the cases are hereby enumerated. GR number 203299, GR number 203306, GR numbers 203335, GR number 203359, GR number 203378, GR number 203391, GR number 203407, GR number 203440, GR number 203453, GR number 203454, GR number 203469, GR number 203501, GR number 203509, GR number 203515, and GR number 203518. Appearing as counsel in GR number 203335 is Attorney Jose Jesus M. Dicini, Jr. Appearing as counsels in GR number 203359 are the following: Attorney Herbert Matienzo, Attorney Renel May Operario. Appearing as counsels in GR number 203378 are the following: Attorney Harry L. Roque Jr., Attorney Romel Regalado Bagares, Attorney Gilbert Terwell Andres. Appearing as counsel for petitioners in GR number 203407 is Attorney Julius Garcia Matibag. Appearing as counsels for petitioners in GR number 203440 are the following: Attorney Maria Patricia Cervantes and Attorney Ray Paulo Santiago. Appearing as counsels for petitioners in 203469 are Attorney Christopher James Purisima. Appearing as counsels for petitioners in GR number 203501 are Attorney Rodel A. Cruz and Attorney Arthur Anthony S. Alicer. Appearing as counsel for petitioners in GR number 203509 is Attorney Edsel Tupas. Appearing as counsel for petitioners in GR number 203515 is Attorney Michael Mela. Appearing for the respondents are the following: Solicitor General Francis H. Ardelesa, Assistant Solicitor General Rex Bernardo Pascual, Assistant Solicitor General Sarah Jane Fernandez, Senior State Solicitor Marcia Ricon, Senior State Solicitor Raymond Rigodon, and Attorney Elvira Josel Castro. Arguing for the respondents is the Solicitor General himself, Solicitor General Francis H. Hardilesa.
The Solicitor General will please approach the podium and manifest whether there is any change from the manifestation that no one will be speaking to argue Section 19.
If Your Honors, please, there is no change, Madam Chief Justice.
The justices have decided to ask clarificatory questions of the petitioners after the interpellations of the Solicitor General has finished. So you are given, you will be asking for 30 minutes to present your arguments. Of course, you can even extend a little more, considering the collective time that had been given for the presentation of the petitioners. But we do appreciate your manifestation that it will be quite an abbreviated presentation. Please proceed, Mr. Solicitor General.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. If Your Honors, please, good afternoon. Respectfully appearing for the Office of the Solicitor General, as always, G, and for the respondents. If Your Honors, please, rapid advances in communications technology, especially the internet and cyberspace, through the use of computers has dramatically changed the way we live, the way we speak with each other, and the way we do business. Sadly, this revolutionary change has given malefactors and criminals a platform to invent a new crime, cybercrime. Republic Act 10175, otherwise known as the Cybercrime Prevention Act, is the response of the state to this new scourge. It criminalizes acts which corrupt and defeat our free access to information in cyberspace. RA 10175 is about the prevention and punishment of criminal conduct. Your Honors, please recall mentally how RA 10175 is organized. While it is divided into 8 chapters, 3 chapters are important: 2, 3, and 4. Chapters 2 and 3 set out the acts punishable under the new law. These acts fall under 2 general categories. First, there are the completely new crimes, and for lack of a better term, we call them cyber crimes proper. An example is hacking. Secondly, there are those crimes already punished under either the revised penal code or special laws, but where the use of ICT is treated as effectively a qualifying circumstance. An example, libel. The next important chapter, Your Honors, is Chapter 4. This one grants the state new investigative tools to effectuate the law, the most important of which is the ability to locate and later on identify the anonymous cyber criminal. And how is this done? Almost literally by tracing back the electronic route that the criminal took in committing his crime. With your indulgence, Your Honor, permit us to illustrate. Let us take computer hacking and how it can be done to break into our online bank accounts. Many of us are fond of downloading from the internet, whether it be a program, a document, an article, a video, or a picture. There are, however, Your Honors, malicious software. In the new language, these are called malware, out there, which are designed to obtain information from us, unknowing hosts working from our computers. And this information is going to be used by the criminal hackers for their criminal and illegal purposes. Akin to a Trojan horse, these so-called malwares are usually hidden or embedded inside legitimate software. In example, the picture that we download from the internet. Many times, our home computers have what they call antivirus programs. But many times, these programs cannot detect or are no match to the programs used by the hackers. Permit me to go back to our example. Imagine we have downloaded a program from the internet and we have installed it in our computer. As I said, we are not aware that Mr. Hacker is out there somewhere. He is the newcomer in the rogues gallery of criminals. He is a techie. He is very bright. Usually, he is very highly educated. He does not carry a gun, but his tools of trade are just as deadly, an arsenal of sophisticated software and programs. To keep to our example, Mr. Hacker embeds a malware, for example, a keylogger, into the program we downloaded. What is a keylogger? A keylogger is apparently a program where it is embedded in our computer. Every time we use our computer, the keys that we type, that we log, go straight to the computer of Mr. Hacker. In other words, if we log on to our online bank account and I key in my password, that data goes straight to Mr. Hacker. So, unknown to us, Mr. Hacker now knows all types of information about us. So, for example, one day we use our computer and we do our online banking. When we key in, when we use our keys from our computer, the keylogger of this criminal gets our account number. He knows which bank we deal with, and to top it all, he gets to know our username, he gets to know our password. Now, since he knows this information, we are now at risk that he will go electronically to our bank. How does he do it? Knowing our password and knowing our user key, he will now directly contact our bank. But, as I said, Mr. Hacker is a techie. He is a genius. He knows that to get to our bank, he has to subscribe. To use the internet, he has to subscribe to what is now called an internet service provider. And there are many commercial ISPs, Globe, PLDT, Bayan, Sun. And he knows that if he uses from his computer his true address, he will be identified. Because every time we use a computer, there is a IP address. So what does he do? Your Honors, he will use a program called an anonymizer. Anonymizer, as in anonymous. This program will give Mr. Hacker multiple fake IP addresses. So he will use this program. It gives him, all of a sudden, his address is out in Spain or in Europe or in Asia. What is the purpose? He knows that law enforcement might come in and he is purposely trying to muddle the situation. All, I must stress, from the safety and anonymity of his computer. Your Honors, in the physical world, this is known as theft. When he steals our money, it is theft. And how in the physical world is the thief apprehended? By good old police work. Investigation. Observation. But cyber, Your Honors, has changed all of that. In our example, to start with, Mr. Hacker is anonymous. He works out of a remote outpost. He did not physically enter our home to get our username. He did not physically enter the bank. So there are no fingerprints. There are no surveillance photos. Remember, after he gets all this data, he can go to the internet, look for our bank's website, log in as if it was us, use our usernames and passwords, and then pay our bills or get our money or transfer our funds to his funds. Luckily, Your Honors, these acts of signing in, making the transfers, leave an electronic trail from Mr. Hacker through his proxy servers. And thus, it is possible for us, if we retrace the route he took, that we will get to know who the hacker is. That route, that electronic trail, shows the origin, it shows the destination, it shows the route, the time, and the date of all of these acts of Mr. Hacker. This is what is called the so-called traffic data. And if the words origin, destination, route time and date are familiar, these are the words of the law when it defines traffic data. Therefore, if we are allowed to retrace the same traffic route that he took when he got to our bank, we may be able to trace and identify Mr. Hacker. The ability to trace Mr. Hacker through the collection of traffic data is the new investigative tool given to law enforcement under Section 12 of Republic Act 10175. This is the Achilles heel of the genius that is the hacker. But, Your Honors, to get to him, the law needs adjustments. The law needs to give law enforcement authorities access to this electronic path. Again, with your permission, may I go back to my example? Under 10175, Section 12 gives law enforcement authorities, as I said, access to collect from the banks, for example, electronic data. Then they can use this information to identify the IP address where the command to sign in was given and where the transfer originated, including the command setting up the transferee account. Your Honors, now, at least in terms of investigation, there is a lead. We know from the bank records the IP address used. Building on this IP address, showing where the unauthorized commands originated, law enforcement can then take the next step. What is the next step? They will apply for a court warrant authorized under Section 14 of RA 10175. The warrant will require the internet service provider to disclose the identity of their subscriber to whom was assigned this IP address. In other words, we have now a chance to know that Mr. Hacker was the subscriber to the ISP. Then law enforcement will take another step. Armed with this name, law enforcement can also petition the court, again, a court, based on probable cause, for a search and seizure warrant against Mr. Hacker, covering not only his house, but also his computer. This step, again, is provided for by law, Section 15 of 10175. Gives law enforcement on probable cause a chance to get a warrant for search and seizure from a court. Assume there is a raid, assume there is a seizure, they went to the house. Forensic examination will be done immediately on the computer. And the computer itself could have confirmatory evidence of Mr. Hacker's act of going to our bank's website. The results of this forensic examination will give, again, law enforcement agents enough evidence to file a criminal case against Mr. Hacker. As a final step, of course, they will seek the issuance of a warrant of arrest. Mr. Hacker will be arrested, tried, and hopefully put away for a very, very long, long time. Your Honors, in a nutshell, that is what 10175 is all about. Now, we turn to the petitions. We ask the petitioners, Your Honors, in all of this, in all of these steps, where is freedom of speech and where is freedom of expression? We ask the petitioners in all of this, where is the right to privacy? Certainly, Your Honors, we submit, Mr. Hacker cannot assert that his hacking skills, his genius, creative as they are a form of constitutionally protected expression or speech. Neither were, Your Honors, we submit, the privacy clauses of our Constitution enacted with the intent to constitutionally protect the anonymity of Mr. Hacker. On the contrary, Your Honors, we submit, privacy laws and the constitutional provision of privacy was put there to protect our privacy. On privacy, Your Honor, permit us. The specter of Big Brother was raised at the last oral arguments. We categorically say 10175 does not authorize 24/7 Big Brother surveillance. That is why we tried, Your Honors. We took the pains to walk you through our example. To repeat, Section 12 of 10175 will only bring law enforcement authorities to an IP address. An address, Your Honors. We understand an IP address is a series of numbers. So the exercise of Section 12 will only bring law enforcement to address. It is not 101 Calao Street. The address is a series of numbers, 12345. So we do not know identity yet. That is how far Section 12 will bring us. To identify the owner of the IP address, law enforcement authorities need to apply, as we said, with the court for the issuance of a Section 15 order to compel the ISP provider to disclose subscribers' information, meaning the name of the subscriber. To search the premises of the culprit and to seize and examine his computer and its data, again, law enforcement authorities must apply with the court again for a search and seizure order. And finally, to get to content, in other words, the content of an email or what is said between two persons, Your Honors, talking through the cell phone, law enforcement authorities will need to apply again with the court for a warrant based on probable cause, again under Section 12. Our point, Your Honor, is in this example, there are three layers of protection before you go to content. The last two requiring judicial intervention. On top of this, Your Honor, we respectfully call your attention that on the same day that our Congress enacted 10175, that is July 25, 2012, our Congress also enacted the Data Privacy Act of 2012. RA 10173. The Data Protection Act of 2012 declares as national policy to ensure that all personal information contained in communication systems in the government and in the private sector are secured and protected. The Act is a comprehensive law that legislates protections to all kinds of personal information, including what are defined as privileged and sensitive personal information. Sensitive information, for example, will include all information about an individual's health, education, genetic, or sexual life. It provides for rules on processing of information and stiff criminal penalties for unauthorized release of information. And remember, Your Honors, you still have the anti-wiretapping law of 1965 and the anti-terrorism law, which authorized wiretaps only upon court order. In the former, through an RTC judge, and in the latter, no less than through the Court of Appeals. Our point, Your Honor, in short, there is no Big Brother, not under 10175. With your indulgence, Your Honor, after that long recital of facts, we go to our first legal point. Many of the petitions are facial challenges on the ground, are facial challenges to RA 10175. But 10175, Your Honors, is a penal statute. And as this Honorable Court said in Estrada versus Sandigan Bayan, they have interorum effect. On this ground alone, the petitions which raise void for vagueness should fail. But Your Honors, many petitioners raise overbreath. Your Honors, we will reserve for our memorandum our arguments on standing and ripeness. But this afternoon, we wish with your permission to confront squarely the invocation of overbreath. We do so because we take seriously assertions of overbreath. We take seriously the claim that 10175 overreaches into protected freedoms, particularly the freedom of speech and expression and the right to privacy. We do so for we in the OSG, equally with the petitioners, are committed to the protection of our constitutional freedoms. We too believe, Your Honors, that freedom of speech is delicate, vulnerable, and needs breathing space to survive. We too believe that without speech, discussions of our most abiding concerns as a nation will be stifled. In fact, Your Honors, it is in this spirit that the OSG, after much thought, has come to our conclusion that Section 19 of 10175, as worded, impermissibly intrudes into speech. Our concession has been chalked up as a victory for the petitioners. Your Honors, with respect, we humbly submit that should this Honorable Court strike down Section 19, the victory will belong to all of us who cherish free speech and expression. But Your Honors, one Section 19 does not make void the whole 10175. We will argue, Your Honor, that apart from Section 19, there are only two provisions in 10175 that implicate speech as to plausibly, and we stress plausibly, raise speech issues. These are 4C4 on libel and 4C3 on spamming. And, Your Honors, there is only one provision, we respectfully submit, that implicates the constitutional right to privacy. Again, to plausibly, and we stress plausibly, raise privacy issues. This is Section 12 on the collection of traffic data. With your permission, Your Honors, permit us to show why these provisions do not raise true and valid speech or privacy issues, and that except as to Section 19, these petitions must be dismissed. First, on libel. Defamation committed through computer systems in the cyberspace has already been held punishable under the revised penal code by this Honorable Court in Bonifacio versus RTC, even before RA 10175 was enacted. Section 4C4 was included to clarify and emphasize that a computer system is but a new means or avenue to commit libel. In short, 4C4 merely added computer systems to the listed avenues or expanded list under the revised penal code. But even without 4C4, computer system, in our view, is definitely included in the term any similar means under Article 355. Libel, Your Honors, as defined and penalized in the RPC and its precursor, Act Number 277, had repeatedly been subjected to judicial scrutiny, and invariably each time, this Honorable Court has sided with free speech, whether under the First Amendment, the Jones Law, or the 1935, 1973, and 1987 constitutions. 111 years after Act Number 277, libel jurisprudence, as it now stands, underscores the vital role played by this honorable court in striking the right balance between the competing social values of the right to a reputation and the freedom of speech and of the press. In 1965, Your Honors, in New York Times versus Sullivan, the U.S. Supreme Court tilted the balance in favor of speech and of press, at least in the case of defamation of public officials and later extended to public figures. This was the introduction of the famous actual malice rule. Beginning in the 1970s and culminating in 1999 in the case of Vasquez versus Court of Appeals, this honorable court gave express approval to and explicitly adopted the actual malice rule. Unfortunately, Your Honors, in the case of petitioner Adonis, this gift of the actual malice rule was wasted. It seems, from what we could gather, it was not even invoked at all, and it did not reach this honorable court. The lesson, though, from this missed opportunity is not that our criminal law on libel is unconstitutional. Perhaps our prosecutors, perhaps libel defense counsels, and lower courts should be more conscious of how they can use the actual malice rule. Wherever the lie, wherever lies the blame, Your Honor, this sad result is not ground to impugn the constitutionality of our criminal libel laws. Is it unconstitutional for the state to criminalize libel? Or otherwise stated, does our libel law violate the right to free speech and free expression? The answer, according to this honorable court, is no. In the words of this court in Gingging versus Court of Appeals, libelous speech does not fall within the ambit of constitutional protection. And it echoed what was famously stated in Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire. Libelous utterances are no essential part of any exposition of ideas. As such, they are of slight social value as a step to the truth, and any benefit that may be derived from them is clearly outweighed by the social interest in order and in morality. Yes, Your Honors, legislation may be enacted to adopt the doctrines on libel, on the actual malice rule, as set by this court. Is it desirable? We agree, Your Honor. Is it necessary, though, legally? Article 8 of the Civil Code says that this honorable court's decisions interpreting the laws form part of the land. We therefore say legislation is welcome, but it is not absolutely necessary. Clearly, Your Honors, we submit the failure to amend our libel laws does not make our libel laws unconstitutional. Are our libel laws unconstitutional because they violate our obligations under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, or what we call the Covenant? Or because, under a general comment, the United Nations Human Rights Committee is of the view that state parties should consider decriminalization of defamation? Or because, in the communication submitted by petitioner Adonis, again the same committee recommends the decriminalization of libel? A respectful answer, Your Honors, is no. The covenant, by its terms, does not obligate a state party to decriminalize libel. Article 19 states in Section 1 that everybody has a right to the freedom of speech. But, in short order, in Section 3, it also recognizes the right to reputation. Certainly, Your Honors, the covenant, if we may, has not found some magical formula to resolve the tension in actual cases, again, we revert to the competing values of reputation and expression, a problem that has bedeviled the courts, including this honorable court, for the longest of time. Your Honors, whether the punishment for injury to reputation be the payment of damages or incarceration, or both, we respectfully submit, is a policy choice for the Congress, our Congress, to make. But regardless, Your Honor, this honorable court had, in January of 2008, in circular number 0808, long before this comment from the UN was issued in 2011, this honorable court already announced its constitutional preference for the imposition of mere fine instead of imprisonment in libel convictions and had so advised trial judges. Sadly, the so-called view on the communication of petitioner Adonis ignored this important contribution of this honorable court to free speech and expression. Moreover, Your Honors, the view merely recommends that state parties may consider decriminalization. And in our view, in our respectful submission, it merely opined that on the facts, the penalty of imprisonment was incompatible with free expression. Your Honors, we do not concede that the view is binding. But assuming it is, just for the record, we want to state that the view was based on several misapprehensions of facts and law. We do not know how the committee arrived at this view that truth is not a defense under Philippine libel laws. It is, Your Honor. It is a defense under Article 361, at least in the case of defamation of public officials, and under the ruling of Vasquez versus Court of Appeals. Your Honors, under the covenant, the committee is a treaty-based group of human rights experts who need not be lawyers. They are formed to monitor compliance with the covenant, examine reports, and rule on individual communications pertaining to the covenant. Your Honors, we respectfully submit, the committee cannot undo, nor has it undone, this honorable court's decision on freedom of expression and of the press. It cannot ignore that this court's decisions are read into our laws. It cannot ignore the clear words of Articles 354 and 361 of the RPC. To allow the committee to prevail over this honorable court's principled rulings spanning a period of over 100 years is, with due respect, just plainly unacceptable. No, Your Honors, we are not violating the principle of pacta sunt servanda. With your permission, Your Honors, let us now go to concerns about new modes of internet communications, namely memes, posters, tweets, shares, Instagrams, comments, and the like, and the role of internet cafes, and the legal status of bloggers. Your Honors, in the debate that preceded 10175, we will hear laymen ask, if an utterance is libelous in the physical world, doesn't it follow that it should be libelous in cyberspace? This man-on-the-street insight, which is commonsensical, surprisingly, Your Honor, finds wide support among commentators in cyberspace law. With your kind indulgence, may we just quote one of them, Professor Sackman et al. In their treatise, Modern Communication Laws. And I quote, in discussing defamation to the advanced technological medium of computer communications, we start with the obvious proposition that defamation is defamation, so long as it meets the common law requirements of the tort. This is true whether we are communicating through smoke signals or through computer modems. The new issues that are raised as a result of the employment of computer communications do not deal with the substance of the communications, but rather the nature of the medium and the allocation of liability between those who are involved in the operation of its use. Your Honors, permit us to paraphrase. What we are about to say is the heart of the case for respondents and for the state in defense of the libel provision of 10175. Because reputation, defamation is defamation. And so long as, in the case of public officials and public figures, our criminal and civil libel laws are construed to apply the actual malice rule, on this condition that this constitutional imperative is met, this proposition, again, that defamation, is true whether we communicate through megaphones, letters, mimeograph materials, photocopied materials, Xerox materials, radio, television, public television, or cable. Or whether we communicate through memes, posters, tweets, shares, comments, Instagrams, and the likes. And, Your Honors, whether we speak as in times past, physically, person to person, or as now, whether we communicate by email, person to person by email, person to person by text, by posts, through blogs, through the internet, or through the internet. And to push it further, Your Honor, this proposition that defamation is defamation holds true also whether we speak from our computers in the privacy of our homes or whether we speak from our computers while we are in an internet cafe. And finally, for the journalists, Your Honor, defamation is defamation, whether the story finds itself in a printed physical broadsheet or in an internet online edition. Let us take memes and posters. Assuming there is a prosecution for alleged libelous memes or posters, the law on the substance of the message of the meme or the post or the poster is already ground covered, Your Honors, in the law of defamation. There are the defenses of the use of satire, parody, hyperbole, figure of speech, and the leeway given to editorial cartoonists. In Falwell versus Flinch, Your Honors, the American court noted the art of the cartoonist is often slashing and one-sided. Yet, satirical cartoons have played a prominent role in public and political debate. And what about like? And what about sharing? Your Honors, a like is an expression of an approval of an utterance. In other words, an expression of opinion. Again, as a matter of substantive law, there is analysis which can be applied by analogy. As Justice Powell famously said in Gertz versus Welch, under the First Amendment, there is no such thing as a false idea. Yet, you compare that with Milkovitz versus Lorraine Journal, Your Honor, that simply couching defamatory statements in terms of opinion does not dispel defamatory implication. Thus, in my opinion, Jones is a liar can cause as much damage to reputation as the statement Jones is a liar. What about share, Your Honor? Does it raise an issue of opinion versus fact, or one of publication or republication. On the liability of the Internet Cafe, Your Honors, it but echoes the question of the boy who delivers the newspaper. Is he an aider or abettor of the libel of the author? What about the Internet service provider? Is it a publisher? Or is it more akin to the newspaper delivery boy? Finally, Your Honors, the blogger. Is he a journalist? Is he a member of the press? He has no editor. He has no publisher. Is he entitled to more or to less freedom of speech? Just because a new medium is used, that is cyberspace, does it entitle libel in the cyberspace to absolute privilege in the criticism of public officials or public figures? But, Your Honors, what about the knowing falsehood? What about the knowing lie? What about the calculated falsehood? Our point, Your Honors, these are interesting issues arising from the new medium, the Internet, and allocation of liability. But judicial resolution of these new issues will not avoid going back to some old rules, meaning existing doctrine which the court may apply, whether wholly, by analogy, or if the court pleases, to break new ground. Your Honors, there will be a time.
Counsel, how many more minutes would you need?
Maybe another 10, Your Honor.
Okay. You would be able to cover all the issues already?
I would think so,
okay,
Your Honor.
With the indulgence of the court.
There will be a time, Your Honors, when these issues will arrive at this court as justiciable cases and controversies. But not yet as of today. As one of the former justices said, borrowing from Shakespeare, ripeness is all, but not today, Your Honors. We now go to Section 6 and Section 7 as they apply to libel. Section 6 effectively treats the use of information technology as a qualifying offense. Its effect is to increase the penalty by 1 degree. Your Honor, Section 6 does not change the nature of the crime as to create another offense. The doubling of the penalty we submit is more apparent than real. Yes, it is up by 4 years and 2 months. But Your Honors, when the indeterminate sentence law is applied, the minimum sentence to be imposed is, after all, 1 degree lower, which actually will go down to the penalty for simple libel. Even then, again, Your Honors, we call attention to your circular 0808, urging trial judges to impose the penalty of fine rather than imprisonment, as this honorable court in all its decisions after circular 0808, this honorable court only imposed fines, not imprisonment. And we finally add, Your Honor, the prescriptive period for the crime of libel remains to be 1 year under Republic Act 4661, despite 10175. Section 7, Your Honor, we respectfully submit, does not violate the constitutional provision on double jeopardy. Will Section 7 put an accused in jeopardy for conviction thrice? First, under 10175, second, under the revised penal code, and possibly a third time under the special laws. Permit us to distinguish, Your Honor. 10175 covers two types of crimes. The first, as we said, the newly defined crimes. The second one, the crimes that are already defined under the revised penal code. As to the second category, Your Honor, we say, ICT is merely used as a qualifying offense or as a qualifying circumstance of the same offense. And therefore, we go direct to its application to libel. Can a journalist who works for the same newspaper, which has both a broadsheet edition and an online edition, be prosecuted for libel twice for the same story which appeared on the same day? We humbly submit no, Your Honors. There are analogous decisions that may apply. Under the single publication rule, the hardcover and the paperback editions of the same book are considered a single publication. And so too, the morning and the afternoon editions of newspapers owned and published by the same owner are considered a single publication. And so with all due respect, Your Honor, we hope this will lay to rest all the anxiety of journalists fearing that they are at risk for double jeopardy under Section 7 of Republic Act 10175. In the interest of time, Your Honor, we will skip Section 19. And with your permission, can we go to my last point, Your Honor, on Section 12? Our last argument, Your Honor, is on Section 12, collection of traffic data. As we have said, Your Honor, the only way to be able to trace back Mr. Hacker is through the use of Section 12. It is the ability of law enforcement authorities to look at how the bank account website was entered into, and from there, get the IP address of Mr. Hacker. As we said, Mr. Hacker will use all types of proxy software. But at the end of the day, if you let Section 12 stand, Section 12 will allow law enforcement to go to the ISP provider and say, look, show me the electronic trail. And at the end of that exercise, Your Honors, the electronic trail will lead to an IP address. That is all that Section 12 is about. But that is so important, Your Honors, because without Section 12, there is no first step to try to identify Mr. Hacker, because Mr. Hacker is anonymous, he uses a fake IP address, he hacks into our bank account. The only lead we have is that IP address. Without Section 12, there is no first step. If you allow Section 12, then law enforcement will go to the next step. And the next steps, as we have said, all involve court participation. With that, Your Honors, we close our argument, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Justice Abad will start interpolations.
Well, you said that online libel is in fact not a new crime. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
It is already covered by the revised penal code.
Yes, Your Honor.
Under the praise or any similar means. Right. Such that even without the Section 4C4, we can be sure that online libel would not be left unpunished. It can still be punished even without 10175.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, is it not in that sense superfluous for Congress to make online libel a crime when, to your mind, the same act is already made a crime by the revised penal code? It was superfluous.
That is a conclusion, and that can be an argument, Your Honor. But somebody else, the Congress, could have...
In fact, if you say it's already punished by by the revised penal code, don't you agree that is superfluous, like repeating a phrase?
It is not superfluous for the Congress, Your Honor, because the whole regime is, they say, everything in the penal code, if committed through ICT, is a crime, but the penalty is step up.
Well, except for the penalty, but the fact is, it's the same crime punished by the revised penal code.
We agree, Your Honor, it's the same crime, but there is a qualifying circumstance.
But we have to presume, don't we, that Congress must have a valid reason for declaring that libel in the cyber world is a crime, apart from the revised penal code. It must have some reason.
Yes, Your Honor, and the debates will show that one of the things that was bothering the Congress was that in cyber libel, the degree of publication is much, much wider. And that seems to be one of the reasons why they believe that
that
the crime
goes
should
into the penalty, you know, you make the penalty higher. Now, are you aware of any criminal action for libel arising from a posting of libelous material in the internet having been prosecuted under the revised penal code before the enactment of the cybercrime law?
I'm not aware, Your Honor.
Notwithstanding that probably billions of such postings have already been made by this time since social networking became a fad?
I'm not aware.
We have not heard, no?
I'm not aware, Your Honor.
That's kind of a phenomenon, no? That the cyber world has created. So, if Congress may be presumed to have a valid reason for doing what is superfluous, that is making libel in the internet a crime, its reason is to clearly extend the force of the law on libel to postings of forbidden materials in the internet. It wants to make it clear that it also applies to the internet, because probably people are not filing cases. So will you agree to that?
I agree, Your Honor. For the avoidance of
clear.
For the avoidance of doubt, the Congress said what is libel on print is libel in the internet.
So we have, in effect, a legislative admission, in a sense, that the law on libel before the passage of the Cybercrime Act does not clearly extend to internet postings.
But with respect, Your Honor, not necessarily.
In a sense, that it is to make a statement that it applies, because, as you said, billions of probably defamatory materials have passed to the internet. Well, for instance, if X authors a libelous posting in the internet that says Mrs. Jones sleeps with this driver and tips him, X would clearly be liable for libel. You agree?
Yes, Your Honor.
He's the author of the libel. If this posting lands on my Facebook because a friend shared it with me in my Facebook address and I was amused by it, I could click a button on the Facebook format where I express my view that I like it because it amused me. Can I do that?
Yes, you can, Your Honor.
Well, does my liking the posting make me liable for libel?
That's why we said, Your Honor, there is a defense of opinion. It is an opinion that somebody likes.
Well, that's the problem, no? Because it's a vagueness, so large, so what do you call that? Because of defense opinion, that's what it will send. It will make me now be reluctant to express my view that I like something that is possessed in the, you know, even if I don't know Mrs. Jones, but the way it is placed, it amused me, and I express my opinion as an amusement. Well, for example, another example, if there is a libelous material posted on a bulletin board in a company office, you read it and then you like it, and then you tell your friend, oh, you go there and you read it. And then he went and he read it. Will I be liable for libel? For showing something that somebody else has posted?
And under the facts you gave, Your Honor, not necessarily. It's an expression, to me, that verges on almost a pure expression of opinion.
So that's not libel?
In my view, no. There, it might not even be republication, Your Honor.
Well, so that's a problem. If unless this law is clarified, it, as I said, it has a chilling effect for those of us who may want to merely express our opinions concerning libelous material that we did not author in the first place. Now, so will you agree with me that the internet, a new media for sharing information, can create fear in the millions using it, that they could be liable for libel if they share with their friends their feelings about a libelous posting that they did not author?
That could be, Your Honor. And
well, if that could be, then this law is bad.
Well,
because it will create a chilling effect on people expressing their opinions.
Can I respond, Your Honor?
No. So I may go to another point.
Just about, I think he, the soldier is asking whether he can respond to your last comment.
Whether he can?
Respond to your last comment.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, on the chilling effect, Your Honor, certainly, yes, it can be argued. But, for example, to the argument that there has been billions and billions of defamatory items and that there has been no prosecution, the argument can also be made. And therefore, why so much worry about the libel law, Your Honor? Our point is these questions of whether like is opinion is already part of existing doctrines. The new medium, the internet, just focuses, puts it in a different perspective, in a different medium as it is. And that's why we go back to our proposition, Your Honor. Defamation is defamation, whether it is said face-to-face in olden times or whether now it is said through cyberspace. Reputation is the same, Your Honor, reputation. And therefore, as we said, it is this court which is the last bastion, the last defense always. In actual case, is like an opinion or is like an endorsement? Well, it's like a republication. We're saying, Your Honor, new medium, it will stretch the analytical capacities of the courts and of the councils, but you go back to old doctrines, whether the court now is prepared to say that because this is cyber and therefore criticism of public officials is absolutely privileged, that is for the court to decide, Your Honor. That foreshadows the question of, is that opinion or is that republication?
Well, I have no problem really with the original author being liable for libel. But as I've seen, a libelous material can be multiplied in 1 or 2 days into millions of sharings.
Yes.
And if one's prosecuted for it, the state can focus on one and not on the millions others who did that. And also, they can select what do you call that? They can probably monitor your computer, find out if you have made any expression like that. Similarly, with millions of others, then they will prosecute you because you shared it with others.
Can I respond, Your Honor?
If you share libelous material that you saw with other persons, do you author it or you just bring him towards the bulletin board and say, read this, posted by other people. I'm not saying this is true. I'm not publishing it myself. It is something that I saw and I just want to share with you. And is that aiding or abetting?
Can I respond, Your Honor?
Yes, please.
I am 100% with you, Your Honor. These are difficult. These are going to be very interesting questions. Yes. But my point is, these are all theoretical questions and under the rules, the court can wait until there is an actual question. In the meantime, Your Honor, because then the counter-argument is things can go viral. What about reputation? When the reputation of a person is solid in a viral explosion, what do we do with reputation, Your Honor? Until our submission, and respectful, Your Honor, is until either the Congress or this court says, reputation is not a value anymore, These are going to remain difficult questions, Your Honor.
Okay. Can I ask questions later on when others are... So the others can ask.
Justice Perez.
Just a follow-up to the question of Justice Abad. Defamation is defamation. And the cybercrime law does is merely to qualify the crime already defined in the revised penal code. It's the same crime. It becomes qualified because it's committed in the internet. If that is so, does that not that collide with Section 7? Why does Section 7 allow the prosecution under both? That's how I read it, because it says without prejudice to any liability for violation of any provision of the revised penal code. Of course, you say that it will not be applied because precisely of double jeopardy. But I say that this provision itself shows that it is objectionable because it allows double jeopardy.
If Your Honor, please, if you will note, Your Honors, libel is mentioned as a content offense, but it is the only content offense that does not carry a special penalty under 10175. So the penalty remains the penalty for the revised penal code. That is the basis for our view that, in fact, whether it was purposive or not, the effect is it protects speech. Libel is the only provision made mention as a content offense where the penalty remains to be the penalty under the RPC, Your Honor.
Simply put, if a person has been accused of libel under the revised penal code, you are saying that he or she can no longer be prosecuted under cyber libel provisions.
That's our respectful view, Your Honor.
Which means to say that that view is against what is provided for in Section 7. I'm saying that if your view is that what the cyber crime law does is merely to qualify the crimes in already defined in the revised penal code or in the special laws or in both, then would it not be better that Section 7 be excised so that any and all fear that there may be a possible a prosecution under two laws will be prevented?
May I respond, Your Honor?
Yes.
With all due respect, Your Honor, for example, the intent of the Congress, let us take the case of pyramid scams. That is, in the real world, estafa. But the intent of the Congress seems to be if the pyramid scam is being advertised through the internet, then you apply one step higher, Your Honor. And there is theoretically two prosecutions, one under plain estafa and another one under using ICT. But we're calling attention, if you keep close attention to the text of 10175, it does not single out libel, Your Honor. That is the basis of our view that in libel, again, whether that was purposive or the result, there can be no double jeopardy.
In other words, Section 7 is not applicable to libel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Justice De Castro, do you say again that this section, Section 7, does not apply to libel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why, will you explain?
For example, Your Honor, in the so-called content-related offenses, for example, take the case of cyber sex. There is a definition of cyber sex. And then, Your Honors, if you look at the penalties, there is a penalty for cyber sex. But, Your Honors, if you look at libel, that is at 4C4, libel, it says, if committed through an ICT, is a crime. But if you look at the table of penalties under 10175, there is now penalty separate from libel. And therefore, our view is the penalty for libel is the penalty under the revised penal code. In effect, libel gets to be a special mention, specially mentioned as a content offense, but the Congress did not provide for a separate penalty for that so-called content libel under a 10175. That is the basis, Your Honor. Now, again, we do not know if it was purposive to protect speech or whatever, but we argue, Your Honor, that is an effect. And that is an effect that should be welcomed, Your Honor, because it protects speech. On the other hand, for example, the scammer, the pyramid scammer who uses the internet, why shouldn't he go to jail twice? Under plain estafa and under internet fraud. In our view, Your Honor, that is a legitimate exercise of police power. There is plain estafa and there is bouncing check estafa, Your Honor. That is the intent of the Congress, Your Honor.
Justice Leonel.
But that is
okay.
Not
Justice De Castro.
But it is not reflected in the language of the law. It only says that a violation of this act is without prejudice to any liability. A prosecution under this act is without prejudice to any liability for violation of any provision of the revised penal code or special laws.
You are right. You are right, Your Honor.
It does not say that these are different offenses, but if the crime is penalized under this special law and there is another provision in the revised penal code or other special law involving the same act, speaks of the same violation. And when you speak of violation, you think of the acts constituting the violation. So that would mean that Section 7 can be read to mean that an act can be subjected to punishment twice. And the double jeopardy does not only prohibit double trial or being tried more than once, but it also prohibits double punishment. So the Section 7 would convey the idea that one can be subjected to double punishment.
Your Honor, can I respond? Section 7, Your Honor, says a prosecution under this act, that's 10175. So libel is a content offense under this act. But what we're trying to say, Your Honor, while it is, 10175 does not provide for a penalty for libel under 10175. Therefore, even if there is a prosecution for libel under 10175 as a content offense, there is no penalty, Your Honor. The penalty remains to be in the RPC. That is the only instance, Your Honor. Now, again, the others, for example, Your Honor, I go back to my example of the pyramid scheme. That is, there is a crime, what we call a truly new crime, Your Honor.
You go to that. But if you look at Section 6, libel will be included in this broad term, all crimes, which will be imposed 1 degree higher, a penalty of 1 degree higher than that provided for by the revised penal code. It does not say that libel is not included here in Section 6.
But
So this covers all crimes. That includes... So you do not apply the provision of the revised penal code on libel when you are using this act, but you will apply Section 6, where, as you said, the offense is qualified and therefore impose a higher penalty than that provided for in the revised penal code.
That is why, Your Honor, our respectful submission is that in a prosecution for libel, under the cybercrime, it has to be under Section 6. This is the same libel under the RPC, Your Honor, but because of the qualifying circumstance in a conviction, the penalty is one step higher. But it's the same libel because 6 kind of incorporates the RPC libel as a cybercrime. But again, 10175 does not place a separate penalty for libel, Your Honor. That's all we're saying. And again, Your Honor, that reading will save Section 6, will save Section 7, will enable the state to run after the pyramid scammers who use the internet, and at the same time protect speech, Your Honor.
So, Justice Leonen has been lining up a long while.
Are you through, Justice?
Let's give it to Justice
later.
Okay. Justice Leonen.
Good afternoon, Counsel. You would agree with me that jurisprudence has already qualified the laws on libel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe for your memorandum as well as for the petitioners, what boggles us is that the definition of libel here points to Article 355 of the Revised Penal Code. And no matter how much I would try to read the Revised Penal Code, libel is defined in Article 353, not 355. I wonder if there is any effect in terms of the interpretation, or this is a manifestation of the lack of attention done by the Congress on the promulgation of this law. But that is for the memoranda. You would agree with me that jurisprudence since 1932 has already made a distinction between mentions of fact and mentions of opinion with respect to libel. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
In fact, that there are some opinions which actually share the idea that a parody is not by itself a libel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Such as, for instance, when we say that we attack a reputation of someone as being ugly, then perhaps it would matter to a Miss Universe, but certainly for the male justices of the Supreme Court, it doesn't really matter in terms of the reputation. Would you agree with that, Counsel? That is a trick question, of course. Also, that we have already qualified the idea of defamation for public officers. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
As well as public figures, as you mentioned in your oral arguments.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as a matter of fact, we say that actual malice is a legal conclusion, that whoever wants to prosecute for libel against that are public officers or public figures must show that there is knowing falsehood or reckless disregard for the truth. Is that not true?
Yes, Your Honor.
And therefore, you are right to say that in our jurisprudence, it is not only that it is false, but it must be shown that there was reckless disregard for the truth. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So this was an amendment of the 1932 provisions in the Revised Penal Code. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, what I don't understand specifically is, it is so sophisticated in terms of doctrine, why is it that here in the law, it repeats libel as defined in Article 355, causing all of this concern that the intent of Congress might be to set us back in terms of the court? Wouldn't it be advisable on the part of the court to put its foot down and therefore say that libel as construed in the text of the 1932 Revised Penal Code is no longer the libel that we accept in terms of this particular court? In other words, why it was so easy for the members of Congress, as it is easy for us now, to know what the doctrine was, in order not to cause all of this fear, to actually make a distinction between defamation of private individuals and defamation of public individuals, to clarify that there is only libel if it is factual, to clarify that there is actual malice that is involved.
I agree, Your Honor.
So we can declare this as unconstitutional because in spite of the doctrines that we have laid down, Congress doesn't seem to have understood that libel in 1932 is no longer libel that we have today.
Well, if Your Honor, can I respond? I agree with the analysis, Your Honor. Now, as to whether, you know, this court will be minded to declare it as unconstitutional, that would, of course, be for the court to ponder, Your Honor. It might invite, you're right, it might invite the legislature to, or force them to, with precision, come out with a new libel law which will include all of the qualifications. On the other hand, Your Honor, we are arguing, and it is up to this Honorable Court, the court can also let 10175B and interpret that, you know, you should read the actual malice rule into all the provisions of the penal code, as was the method, with all due respect, in Vasquez versus Court of Appeals and all the other cases, Your Honor. But again, those are for the Honorable Court's decision.
And it is possible that the regional trial court in the Adonis case might have been mistaken, because what the regional trial court judge did was read the text of the law and actually apply only the text of the law and not look at the jurisprudence. And therefore, there is this danger that indeed there may be cases which will infringe upon freedom of expression simply because, again, the law is not very clear.
I agree, Your Honor.
Is this the concept of overbreath, counsel?
I'm sorry.
Is this the concept of overbreath? That the law is too broad, that there can be misinterpretations that borders on the that traverses the border between unconstitutional and constitutional?
No, Your Honor. Well, in the case of libel, Your Honor, arguably, but I keep calling back your attention. The most of the 21 or so provisions of 10175 have to do with cybercrime, Your Honor. And we are afraid that lest this destruction, if you may, on libel, because we go back to the example, our bank accounts are at risk. There is no freedom of expression involved in the case of what we call Mr. Hacker.
Yes.
I do appreciate all of the concern on libel, Your Honor.
We will go to that later, but may I go a bit deeper in terms of the concept of libel? Because you mentioned, I am not too fond on arguing on with American cases, but you mentioned the case of Chaplinsky. This is with respect to the draft, fighting words, etc. What I know of is that it has been overturned in terms of its principle in the case of O'Brien versus United States. But again, I do not want to argue in terms of United States cases. In fact, fighting words, it is said, may not have its place in the free market of ideas, you are correct. But then the value of free speech is not only to contribute to a market, but also the ability of a person to protect the ability of a person to express themselves. Isn't that also a principle embedded in our own freedom of expression clause? The ability to express oneself rather than simply being allowed to express only if you contribute to a political or other opinion.
I agree, Your Honor, that your analysis is one point of view, whether or not Chaplinsky was directly overturned or Bryan. Our point is there will be a time and place for an actual case on symbolic speech to reach this court. And until then, our plea is let 10175B.
Because you did mention that this court has issued a circular stating that the preference is no longer imprisonment but rather fines. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then wouldn't it be just a small step for us to actually go further and say that the best way to protect libel, as the petitioner would argue, it did argue, in fact, the other time, is via a civil action, which is always available to them, rather than make use of the offices of the prosecutors, the Department of Justice, to mediate between two private individuals?
Well, again, Your Honor, that is a view, but another person can arrive at a view that in the case of a knowing lie, no less than a jail term would be the appropriate remedy for injury to reputation. And again, these are matters, Your Honor, that we respectfully submit are for the elected branches to decide.
I will reserve my other questions for
you. Yeah, let me now go to the to my right, Justice Carpio.
Counsel, you conceded to Justice Leonen that our jurisprudence today, one, requires actual malice for a public official to sue on libel. Two, truth is an absolute defense. And third, a fair comment on an official act can never be libelous, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, with this jurisprudence of the court, it's very well established. Article 354 cannot stand constitutional scrutiny anymore, correct?
We agree, Your Honor.
Okay. So, you said it's up to the court to declare this article unconstitutional, along with 361, which says even if it's true, you still have to prove good intentions and good motive. As far as public officials are concerned, I think truth is already an absolute defense. Now, you mentioned a while ago that if it's a penal law, like in the case of the plunder case of just of former President Estrada, a penal law cannot be facially attacked. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
But there's an exception to that, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
If the penal law suppresses freedom of speech, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So this can be facially attacked by petitioners, correct?
With all respect, our position is libel is unprotected speech, Your Honor. It is speech, but unprotected.
Yeah, but it can be if the libel law, if a law provides for a penalty and it suppresses at the same time freedom of expression, it can be facially attacked, correct?
Again, Your Honor, with respect, if our starting point is, yes, libel is speech, but it is unprotected speech. That is why you have a criminal libel law, Your Honor.
What do you mean by unprotected speech?
That is the teaching of Czaplinski, Your Honor. Speech.
Czaplinski, by the way, I invoked that in one case, MVRS case versus Islamic Daiwa. I lost there. The majority rejected Czaplinski. We have a case already here. Fighting words are not actionable because of freedom of expression, freedom of worship. So you cannot use Czaplinski. Anyway, counsel, my question is simple. Can petitioners question facially the constitutionality of Article 354 and 361?
Well, as I said, Your Honor, it is our respectful submission that it cannot, but I hear your arguments, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's go to traffic data. You still carry a calling card, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in your calling card, you have your telephone or cell number, cellular number, correct?
Not my cellular number.
Your landline.
My landline, Your Honor.
Supposing now a policeman gets hold of your calling card because you give it around, correct? And now he goes to the PLDT and says, I want the traffic data of this telephone number. Does he need a search warrant to do that?
Not under 10175.
He does not need?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So he is able, he can get the traffic data from PLDT, correct? Without a search warrant, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, provided okay. He should have due cause.
Due cause. Okay, let us say that he was authorized to get traffic data from PLDT by his boss. Okay. So he gets the traffic data. What is in that traffic data? What is the meaning of traffic data? It says the original call. What is the, how does the law phrase it? The origin. What is the origin? That is your number, telephone number. The origin, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so the traffic data will show your telephone number. It will show the destination, the number called, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
It will state the date, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
It will state the duration, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
It will state the route, maybe Manila to Makati, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. It will state the kind of a message, whether it's a text or a voice, or maybe web use, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, all of this is in your phone bill, actually. This is the data in your phone bill.
Yes,
except there is your name, there is your address, and your account number. But if you blacken that out, that is what the policeman is asking PLDT to give to him.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So you think that it does not violate your right to privacy if the PLDT will give this traffic data to the policeman?
Under
the policeman will know now, early at, in the morning, whom you are calling, how long you have called all of these people. It will establish a very strong pattern on what you are actually doing. It does. Do you think? Do you still think it does not intrude into your right of privacy?
Our answer, Your Honor, is that under the existing rulings of this court, this court, or even previous courts, have not ruled on what is traffic data.
But the law defines traffic data now, and the policeman will go to PLDT. This is the law. I mean, I don't need a search warrant to get this kind of data. So PLDT will give. Is that constitutional? Does that violate your right to privacy?
Our answer, Your Honor, is it is constitutional because under the present state of the law, this court or previous courts have not said that traffic data is covered by the constitutional right to privacy. That is why, Your Honor, in our memorandum, we say it is constitutional, but
until we declare it's not. That's what you're saying.
If I may, but barely.
But I want to know, what is really the law? Is it constitutional? It doesn't, forget about our decision. What do you think? Would you, if it happens to you, would you raise the defense of privacy?
If it happens to me, Your Honor, I cannot argue privacy because the data on telephone is external data, Your Honor. Therefore, if Your Honor please,
but
that is not covered by privacy. But, Your Honor, as we have said in our memo, and with all due respect to the Congress, taking as instructive the experience, for example, in the United States, in that jurisdiction, springing from the same premise that there is no constitutional right to privacy, their Congress gave a statutory right. Traffic data can be exercised only if the trigger is not any kind of law enforcement authority, but a federal United States attorney going to a judge, Your Honor. But that is
but
statutory.
But don't have that here. Here, it's any police officer can do it.
That is why, Your Honor, I'm saying it is constitutional, but barely. That's my answer, Your Honor.
Okay. So you will not object if this policeman will find out whom you are calling every day, and probably he will. It's easy to check. If you have the number, you'll find out the person.
If I find out, Your Honor, and there is no due cause, I will file charges against that policeman.
What do you mean by due cause?
There should be a good faith law enforcement reason, Your Honor.
Who will determine due cause?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, that's one of our own misgivings about the law. It is
so it's the police himself who will determine due cause because he doesn't have to show due cause to our judge, correct?
You're right, Your Honor. That's why, again, I'm saying...
So isn't that unconstitutional?
What I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is no, because this court has not said that that is required. Because, Your Honor, the difficulty is that is what they call outside data. If...
Okay. You say outside data, so there must be inside data. What is the difference?
The inside data in a telephone medium, Your Honor, is the what is being talked about.
So it's the conversation.
Yes, or the content, as they call it now.
So you don't consider as confidential how many times you call a certain person, how long you talk to a certain person. For you, it's not private, that's not covered by privacy.
It is confidential, Your Honor. It is covered by my privacy. But you allow the state where there is a law enforcement reason, that is why due cause.
But
then,
they never allow the state. If I have a right to privacy, I want to keep it. But the law says No, you cannot keep it. That's why we are here today. We have to determine whether it's a reasonable intrusion into your right to privacy. You agree that these are private data, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But my response, Your Honor, is if we follow that line of reasoning, the case of the hacker, Your Honor.
Yeah, but you can always go to the judge to get a search warrant. The judge is always there. If you want, we can designate a judge 24 hours a day. You can go to his house.
I agree with you, Your Honor. I would wish that the Congress had legislated appearance before a judge. But I'm saying, as it is, that's why in our memo we say it is constitutional, but our view, and we say this with utmost respect to the Congress, personally, Your Honor, my rights will be better protected if there is judicial intervention. We have said that in the memo, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's put it in perspective now. You said that you agreed with me that this traffic data is private data, your own. You're discovered by privacy, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
But you are saying it is outside data, not inside. So can you reconcile that?
Can I give you an example, Your Honor? In the physical world, if the police are investigating a crime, for example, they can, what they know, case the joint. I have my home. They are outside. They do surveillance. That invades my privacy. I don't like people outside my home, but they don't need a warrant, Your Honor. And that is what the case law on cyber is all about. That is what they call the outside data. In a letter, Your Honor, in a letter used, posted through the mails, there is an envelope. They call that content. That's the inside data. The outside data is the return address or the address of the person to whom it is sent. Under jurisprudence, at least in the United States, that outside data is not covered by privilege because the person has no reasonable expectation of privacy because you know the sender of the letter knows very well that the postal authorities see the outside. The same reasoning, Your Honor, is used with the telephone. That's why the jurisprudence in the States is that traffic data, the fact that there's a telephone number, provided you don't listen in, you don't wiretap, that is considered outside data for which there is no Article 3, Section 2 need for a warrant, Your Honor.
Okay.
As a matter of constitutional law. That is why I keep saying, even if that is not, there is no privacy, as a matter of constitutional law, the Congress, of course, can come in and give statutory protection. All we're calling attention, Your Honor, there is some statutory protection. The threshold is law enforcement authority, due cause. We agree, Your Honor, the threshold is low. It could be higher. I wish it was higher, Your Honor, but it is constitutional.
Okay, let's go back to outside data. You're saying that if the police conduct surveillance on you when you go out, you go to the house of someone, you visit, you cannot object because you are seen in the public, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So because you know that you are under surveillance, you call the person instead of going to him. You're still saying that because you don't want. You want to keep it confidential that you're going to that house. Now you're saying the police can also get your traffic data. So isn't that intrusion into something that you want to keep to yourself?
The answer, Your Honor, is when the police do a surveillance, they are collecting traffic data, meaning where did I come from, where am I going?
Yeah, but that is visual, you see. That's visual. But this one is not visual.
But that precisely,
Your Honor. You can only get this if you open my telephone bill. You can only get this if you open my telephone bill. It's a content in the letter sent by PLDT to me. And yet you want them to go to PLDT and just get it. Is that still outside data?
And under the regime of 10175, Your Honor, that is considered outside data. That's why law enforcement is given the power on due cause to talk to the ISP provider and say, let me look at that. Now, we can agree or disagree whether the threshold is high or low.
But we already agree said that it is private data. It's subject to privacy.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, in the law on privacy, what do we do if there is a law enforcement need? There is an intrusion, Your Honor. That's why it's unreasonable searches and seizures. Not all intrusions are unconstitutional. It is only if it is unreasonable, Your Honor.
Okay.
And therefore...
Let's go to another point. Let's say I type a letter. Okay, it's a libelous letter. I use my computer, of course. But I don't post it. And then I send it by mail. Is that online libel or ordinary libel?
Under the facts, Your Honor, I think that's... I submit that's ordinary libel.
Ordinary libel, even if I used a computer to print out the libelous material.
Yes, Your Honor, because it seems like under the facts, the computer is used as merely a word processor or akin to the old-fashioned typewriter, Your Honor.
So if I now put it in, I sent it, instead of sending it by mail to my friends, I email it to them. Is that now online libel?
Yes, Your Honor, under those facts.
Why?
Because there is use of an ICT, Your Honor. It goes so, through an electronic facility, Your Honor.
So it is now punishable by 1 degree higher?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why should it be punished 1 degree higher when I just sent it to the same number of people? It's an email. It's nobody else will read it but them.
From as much as we can glean, Your Honor, from the legislative debates, the proposition is that, as was mentioned, getting to the cyber world gives possible audience of millions, if not billions.
But here there is no possible audience of millions. I just send it to 5 friends. The same friends I would have sent it by ordinary mail.
Our answer, Your Honor, would be in the physical world, there is libel even if the libel is through a pamphlet, mimeograph at that distributed, and the libel is from a broadsheet that has a circulation of 50.
No, and no, I'm not talking about a newspaper here. It's a libelous material that I sent to 5 people. So there's publication, 5 people.
Our point, Your Honor, is in our understanding of the libel laws, the number of persons would not be necessarily a factor. So that a libel...
Yeah, that's why I said, I just sent it to 5 people by ordinary mail. You said it's ordinary libel. If I email it to the same 5 people, it now becomes cyber libel, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Because, again, the state says, if you use this new medium, this new facility, I will punish you more. And if I may, Your Honor, it is, again, I go back to the example
so
of...
So you're saying that it is the use of the Internet...
Yes, Your Honor.
...that makes it a cybercrime.
Yes, Your Honor.
So any use of a computer that is not connected to the Internet is not covered by this law?
Theoretically, yes, Your Honor.
No, I mean, it's not theoretical. Yes or no? It's a legal question.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's not covered. So you're taking the position that this law requires connection of your computer to the Internet?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, but the law doesn't say that. I do not see any provision here which says you have to be connected to the Internet. Can you point to me
the definition
basis of your answer?
The definition of ICT, Your Honor. I'm sorry, the definition of computer system, Your Honor.
Yes. It does not say you're connected. It just says you are the medium.
Device or group of interconnected or related devices, Your Honor.
Where?
Section 3G, Your Honor.
G. Does it say here? It says... may stand alone or be connected in a network or other similar devices. It does not say you have to be connected.
in relation also to Dear Honor, the computer.
Yeah, if you define the computer, it says here, it covers any, including devices like smart computer connected to the internet. So including, it says any device including those that are connected. So there is no requirement.
Well,
but you want it to be a requirement now so that it will become sensible. Otherwise, it's not sensible.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, we have a different view. In with all respect...
Point to me the specific provision that requires internet connection.
As we try to point out, Your Honor, G in relation to D.
D, computer refers to an electronic
computer system
magnetic,
in relation to computers. Even the examples are very clear.
Yeah, it does not say connected. All of this need not be connected to the internet.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, we have a different reading.
Yeah, but this is a... Remember, you're imposing a 1 degree higher penalty. This is criminal statute. You have to strictly construe it against the state and in favor of the accused. I don't see anything here that says you have to be connected to the internet.
The last sentence of D, Your Honor.
D.
It is an enumeration of mobile phones, smartphones, computer networks, and other devices connected to the internet.
Yes, it covers any, letter D, it covers any type, including devices that may be that are connected to the internet. But it doesn't say it's required. It says all of this equipment, including this, that are connected to the internet. It doesn't say that all those are required. Okay, that's all, counsel.
Justice De Castro.
Just a small remark with respect to that. The paragraph that you read also said that the computer system may stand alone or be connected to a network, so it may stand alone. Now, let's go back to due cause, which the law enforcement officer may determine. When you determine due cause, what kind of function will the law enforcement officer be doing? Is this an executive function, a quasi-judicial function, or a judicial function?
It's an executive function, Your Honor.
Determining due cause?
Yes, Your Honor.
When did the law enforcement officers determine due cause? They usually only engage in fact-finding investigation. Determination of due cause or probable cause, we equate that with the quasi-judicial function, like...
Your Honor, if...
okay, you explain.
If I go back to the example of Mr. Hacker, due cause is when I complain that my bank account was hacked, I report it to the authorities, they start an investigation, that is due cause. They will go to the ISP provider under Section 12. They'll say, can you share with me the path, the electronic path, to get to the IP address? That is a definition of due cause, Your Honor.
That example will not apply to all situations. There are instances where it may not involve hacking, and yet a law enforcement officer may say there is due cause in the... The law does not define what due cause means
and how
it will be determined. And who will initiate the determination of due cause? Will it be the law enforcement officer on his own? Will he be conducting surveillance operations so that he can find due cause to do it? Or will he wait for a complainant to start the process? The law does not say how due cause shall be determined.
You're right, Your Honor.
Justice Bersamin.
Thank you, Chief. Good afternoon, Mr. Solicitor General. One of the grounds of attack or challenge to the constitutionality of 10175 is that it violates the due process clause of the Constitution, the guarantee of to all people who might be colliding with any provision of this law, to assure them that they had sufficient notice of what this law is all about and what this law may soon punish if they so violated. Now let me direct your attention to this provision on libel. I am particularly interested in your explanation or justification for the term any other similar means which may be devised in the future. Now it seems to me that this provision does not contain any objective standard or does not suggest any objective meaning to this term similar means that may be devised in the future. Now let me imagine a situation way ahead of time. Supposing there will be a device where by mere thinking a person could already relay through the internet what he wants, what he thinks of another, whether in bad light or in good light. Will that be something that will be covered by this?
I my respectful submission, Your Honor, is yes. If there is injury to reputation, yes. Because there is publication, yes, Your Honor. There is a communication of a defamatory statement to another person. Only the medium has changed. Instead of a newspaper, it is now something that can be invented in the future. And the progression, Your Honor, is the same. In the beginning, it's face-to-face, so you have slander. And then you have pamphlets, so it becomes libel. In the beginning, Your Honor, radio was slander because, you know, it's supposed to be fleeting. But because radio has such a wide audience, radio, defamation by radio, became libel. So, as I say, Your Honor, the medium can change, but the first principles are the same. Do we want to protect reputation? If we do, then there will be a punishment for libel. Whether or not it is jail or a fine, that's for the Congress to decide. So my answer, Your Honor, is that would be an example of something, a device that can be invented in the future.
Even if under that situation, it was only the thought that projected the...
Yes, Your Honor. And we, for example, the case was, the scenario was asked, assuming there is no 10175, similar devices is in the present libel law, I would assume that internet defamation is a defamation under a similar device when in 1932 nobody knew that there was going to be an internet. As I keep saying, Your Honor, the medium can change, but the first principles are the same. The competing values are the same. Does it injure reputation? If it does, what do we want to do about it? You can't.
All right. But let me bring you back to the present. A computer system does not operate without touch.
Yes, Your Honor.
So where does the word similar go?
Again, Your Honor, I think if there is an invention in the future where you don't have to touch, but brain waves can say, click, you know, I send, again, the medium will change because of technology, but you go back. Is a message being sent? Yes, it is speech. Is it defamatory? If it is, you go back to the old conundrum. Is there injury to reputation? What does the society want to do about it? The medium will change, Your Honor, definitely. But
so does that not violate this standard of giving due process to all people who might ever run in with this law?
I will argue respectfully, Your Honor, that a person of ordinary human intelligence would know that in the future there will be inventions. And whether or not there is an invention, again, you go back, whether it is a new invention, you go back to the question, why did you have to injure somebody else's reputation?
Well, I happened to have watched a movie when I was younger. There was this Sylvester Stallone having virtual sex without touching. Now, that can be in the near future possible. Now, is that also a probability in this, that that might be considered a violation of libel?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the in a future prosecution on cyber sex, that could possibly come up as an issue, Your Honor.
Is that not violating the freedom to think?
I would think it probably could, depending on the circumstances, Your Honor.
All right. Another point here that I find to be a weakness in this law, let me just put it that way, is that one in Section 5B, attempt in the commission of cybercrime. Now, we have a conventional meaning of attempt in the revised penal code, but that seems not to be carried into this provision. The conventional definition of attempt in the revised penal code is that there must be an overt act. All right? Now, you don't seem to require that here, or does this provision demand an overt act?
Well, there is no definition, Your Honor. We
so
agree.
Even if someone is just thinking about doing something without yet translating into any kind of overt action, what he is thinking, is there a possibility he might become accountable, criminally speaking?
I would not think so, Your Honor. Again, one of the tools that the courts would have will be using analogy based on present doctrines. And I fully agree with you, Your Honor. In a prosecution for attempt of a crime, certainly defense counsels would raise the existing law on attempt under the RPC, Your Honor.
Now, my last point is this. Let me go forward, leapfrog to Section 21. This is about jurisdiction. You have put here, the law puts here that the regional trial court has jurisdiction over violations of the provisions of this act. My particular attention, however, was called to this particular word, partly situated in the country. Partly. Does that mean that anyone who transmits libel from outside the Philippines will not ever be subjected to this provision?
That could be a possibility, Your Honor. Among others, we have the problem of jurisdiction over a party who is outside, Your Honor.
Right. Only the recipient in the Philippines will probably be liable if he resends the message.
Possibly, Your Honor. I agree with you.
So the authorship will be irrelevant.
That would seems to be the case, Your Honor.
Now, right now, we have a definition in Section 2 of the words computer system. Shall that definition be controlling when we apply this provision on Section 21?
I would think so, Your Honor, yes.
Thank you.
Justice Peralta, then Justice Del Castillo.
Just for clarification, Mr. Solicitor General, cybercrime, the penalty is 1 year higher. Did I get you right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought all the while that if the libel under this law is libel under 355, that said similar means is the element of the crime of libel. So if it is done through publication, then the penalty is the same as libel under 353 or 355, is it not? So that if the libel is done through information, then it's simply a libel under the revised penal code. I thought that's what you were saying. So it does not increase the penalty by 1 degree, because the use of the information is the means of committing the crime of libel. It is an element of the crime in itself. Do you agree with me?
With your permission, Your Honor, we will study that angle.
That's what I understand now from what you were saying, because what I believe the meaning of Section 6 is that it is a qualifying circumstance. It is a qualifying, in fact, it's not a qualifying circumstance. It is a qualifying, it's a qualifying circumstance because it increases the penalty of a crime that is defined in the revised penal code. I'll give you an example, kidnapping for ransom. If the ransom is done through the internet, then the penalty should be 1 degree higher. And therefore, Section 6 places the crime under the revised penal code into a higher degree or a higher category. Is that do you think that's also that is the interpretation under Section 6?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's more of a qualifying circumstance of a crime that is already defined under the revised penal code or under a special law. But if that is the means of committing the crime of libel, then it is the penalty of libel. It is not, does not increase to 1 year because that is the means of committing the crime of libel. It's like committing a crime of libel through publication, committing a crime of libel through television or radio. This one is committing a crime of libel through the internet. So why do you have to increase the penalty? It is a means of committing the crime of libel. Is it not?
As I said, Your Honor, we those are very insightful comments, and we will cover that in the memorandum, Your Honor. Yeah. And thank you for...
I was thinking of, because you were giving an example about syndicated estafa. Syndicated estafa is punishable by special law, but that is estafa also covered by 3315 of the revised penal code. If it is done through an internet, then the penalty will be higher by 1 degree, but it does not change the nature of the crime. It is still estafa, a syndicated estafa.
Yes, yeah. Your Honor.
Like what I said in kidnapping for ransom, it is done through, the demand of ransom is done through internet. That is still a crime of kidnapping for ransom, but the penalty will be higher because it is done through the internet.
We agree, Your Honor.
So my next question now is, if that is the case, then there's something wrong with Section 7. Because if you are charged with kidnapping for ransom, and that is under the revised penal code, with the ransom done through the internet, you can no longer be prosecuted under the revised penal code. Because that will be clearly falls under double jeopardy, because you are charged with the same offense.
Well, that is where we will differ with respect, Your Honor. We say these are different offenses, Your Honor.
But if there are the same elements, you cannot. That will be clearly double jeopardy. Unlike in BP 22, as your example, in BP 22 as estafa, you can be prosecuted under BP 22, and you can also be prosecuted under estafa under 315. Is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
But if the same elements, if the two crimes have the same elements, then there is double jeopardy.
That is right, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay, that's all, Mr. Solicitor General.
Thank you, Justice.
Counsel, it seems to me now that because Congress did not define the phrase JUCOS in Section 12 of cybercrime law, this power now of government to collect and record traffic data is subject to abuse. You were saying earlier that any policeman who believes that a crime has been committed, or would just, for instance, in the example you gave earlier, could go to any of the process servers, at any of the service providers, and collect data.
That is right, Your Honor.
Would you know why Congress did not define this in much the same manner as it defined traffic data in the law?
Well,
why was it not defined?
We don't really know, Your Honor.
The collection and recording of this traffic data, would it also involve electronic banking transactions?
Yes, Your Honor, just like in our example.
Wouldn't that be in violation of bank secrecy law?
No, Your Honor, if you have 101.75. Because it is like a hot pursuit of the hacker, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Just one observation, because I was listening a while ago to the issue on the parameters of the crime. I would suggest that you look at the title of the act itself. It's called Cyber Crime Prevention. And there's a definition of what cyber is. It says the electronic medium in which online communication takes place. In other words, a standalone without any communication is not covered. There should be communication, there should be online, etc. And therefore, there is a definition of what is the coverage of the crime.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
What is the standard for stop and frisk actions? Is there a necessity to get a warrant for a policeman to do stop and frisk?
No, Your Honor. It will be in accordance with the exigent circumstances. If there's some cause, and then there can be allowed exchange of words. If there is a threat to life, then the policeman can go and stop and frisk, Your Honor.
So standing now in People versus Posadas and other cases is the concept of reasonable suspicion depending upon the experience of the policeman, and this is simply because of the exigencies of that circumstance. Would you know also the basis for search of moving vehicles?
Basically, almost the same, Your Honor. Experience, you can stop the vehicle, a look from the outside, maybe an exchange of words, how are you, but no search of the inside of the vehicle, Your Honor.
So it is still a search, but the reasonability of the search is provided by the circumstances, and the reasonability is also in the limitation of the extent of the search in terms of that vehicle. And would you agree with me that the reason why there are exceptions to the getting of a search warrant for these instances is again because it is so evanescent or exigent that by the time you can get a warrant, the vehicle would be gone, or that the perpetrator, in case of, you mentioned casing the joint, would no longer be there?
Yes, Your Honor. In the case of cyber, the word they use is the ephemeral character of the data transmitted. The ephemeral character, which is very fast, and the huge amount of data that can be sent in exchange in a very, very short period of time. You're right, Your Honor.
Mr. Solicitor General, are you aware of the group called Anonymous Philippines?
I have read about it. You know.
Yes, and that they have actually, for purposes of this exercise, that they have actually posted or altered the government websites. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you guide us through the possible ways by which they may be caught in terms of law enforcement? In other words, can they only be caught on the basis of a visual sight? That people will look for them, perhaps there is somebody that looks like Anonymous Philippines, etc., and they will be caught? Or would you necessarily go into some kind of inspection of data that traverses our interconnected network?
You need, Your Honor, as we stress in our example, because of anonymity, the attack comes from a computer. You don't have a face, Your Honor. Short of the police having a deep penetration agent in the ranks of that group. So the answer is we need the leads through the electronic trail, Your Honor, to be left by this group.
Would you agree with me, Mr. Solicitor General, that the current state of jurisprudence, under our current state of jurisprudence, considering People versus Marty, for instance, that it is easier for the private sector to actually inspect the data that passes or traverses the internet, because from the jurisprudence of this court, that is not considered a search protected under Section 2 of Article 3.
I'm sorry, I did not get that.
If it were a private person that tried to go after Anonymous Philippines, that would not run afoul of Section 2, Article 3 because of People versus Marty. Is that not correct? That searches by private persons made of things that are protected apparently by Section 2 are not covered by the injunction in Article 3, Section 2.
Yes, Your Honor, assuming the private party has the resources, but from my small understanding, Your Honor. For example, the IP address, that's lodged only in the victim. And tracing back the IP address needs the ability, the cooperation of the ISP provided to show these are the stops made. So,
In other words, for instance, it would be a large corporation that is hacked. Then they would have the resources to actually run after the hackers. But on the other hand, if it were only a person like some of us here that have blogs that were hacked, that it would be very difficult for us to do so. Is that not correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes. And if I may be allowed, the other reality, Your Honor, is that the big corporations, because they have the money, they have more sophisticated defenses against invasion. That's why, you know, we ordinary citizens can have, you know, an antivirus, just like I have my children. But the banks, Your Honor, but they spend a lot of money having really sophisticated but translated expensive antivirus, Your Honor.
So it is clear to us that there is an interest in law enforcement in terms of the internet. But on the other hand, it is also clear to us that there has to be certain rights to privacy that is protected. And the balance here must be something that is in between what we have now, which is warrants. And on the other hand, stop and frisk action of the physical world. And to define it in the internet, considering the nature of all of this. And in your comment, you mentioned that perhaps the key is the nature of the data packets that goes around the internet, that there is what you call traffic data, which is covered here and in the Budapest Convention, and there is the non-traffic data that is there.
Yes, Your Honor.
How does this square with Section 3 of Article 3 of our Constitution, if I may read? The privacy of communication and correspondence shall be inviolable except upon lawful order of the court. Now, would you know of any judicial standard by which this court, this is separate from Section 2. Section 3 looks at the privacy of communication per se. And what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, counsel, is that in Section 2, the police already knows that a crime has been committed and they have a suspicion of the person that has committed the crime. But in Section 3, this is an infringement on privacy without a crime that has been committed, but only in a preventive sense. Is that not correct, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, and here it says, except upon lawful order of the court. So in our jurisdiction, it appears that there has to be court intervention. Is that not correct?
You're right, Your Honor, in a purely private matter. But 10175 is about crime, Your Honor.
Yes, but in 10175, it simply says that the government can come in for due cause. It does not say that it's a judicial authority, in spite of the fact that Section 3 says upon lawful order of the court. But to be fair, counsel, there is a qualifier. Or when public safety or order requires otherwise as prescribed by law. But looking at the Cybercrime Regulation Act, would you say that there is enough judicially determinable standards to say when public safety or order requires otherwise? Or are we not giving too much a blanket authority to the authorities to inspect every packet of data that is available out there?
As we said in our comment, Your Honor, the regime cuts it too close for comfort. It's constitutional. But we agree. There can be more robust procedural safeguards, Your Honor.
May I go to briefly to another topic already raised, and this is on cybersex. The standard that appears here appears to be the standard in a very old case, in the Cottinger case, which was already overruled in the case of Gopin. This is to look at the picture as a whole, and then later by the cases of PITA versus Court of Appeals, Fernando versus Court of Appeals, and then to a limited extent, this later case of Soriano versus LaGuardia. And again, the same question that I asked in relation to libel. Our provision on cybersex seems to be a throwback to the older concepts of obscenity, which is anything that shocks the senses, which this court has already said is not the standard. Would you say that this too infringes on privacy rights too much?
With respect, Your Honor, our view is that the cyber sex provision is not a rewrite of all of those cases. The cyber sex provision of 10175 is not an anti-obscenity provision. If the legislative debates show that the purpose was to curb online prostitution, that is, live sex going on in chat rooms and in the internet, Your Honor. And so the focus of the engagement is the maintainer, Your Honor. And if we may, cyber sex is not akin to 201 of the penal code, which gave rise to all of these cases. Cyber sex is more akin to 341, which is the white slave trade, and very much later, the anti-trafficking laws, Your Honor, where the concern now or the protection now goes to where the sex worker is not treated as a criminal but as a victim. And therefore, Your Honor, the legislative debates very clearly show, for all the loose language, this targets online cyber prostitution, not obscenity, Your Honor.
Precisely, counsel. As you mentioned, it is loose. Our laws on white slavery in the revised penal code and in many other provisions are quite detailed. But here it appears that we are introducing, as you said, a new crime. And this is in terms of cyber sex. Forgive me if I will ask, just for the public to not misinterpret this next question, I would just want to say that all of us have their own levels of morality and spirituality and religion. But I do have to ask, is it within the state's authority to interfere into choices made with respect to sexual intimacy? For instance, if a person wants sex for consideration and they are consenting adults, isn't that supposed to be within freedoms that is protected by the Constitution? You may not agree with it, I may not agree with it, but far from it for the state to tell us how we conduct our own sexual intimacies.
I agree with you fully, Your Honor.
So there's something wrong with this provision.
That's where I will disagree, Your Honor. With respect, as I said, this is not about consenting adults, having a camera. This is, I repeat, about prostitution. The target of this is the maintainer who, there is an engagement, of course, of the victim, the woman, but the maintainer who maintains, controls, operates directly, or the exhibition, Your Honor, the exhibition or the sexual activity with an aid or a computer system for favor or consideration. Again, in cyber prostitution, these are the maintainers who victimize the Filipinas in our country and then sell this to foreign hosts, foreign sites. That is the purpose of this provision. This is not an anti-obscenity provision, Your Honor.
Again, a lot will agree with the intention, but then the provisions as worded can be so broad so as to control. You see, I think the way that we relate to others, and this is also in relation to our emotions and intimacies, can be very much controlled by the state, given the kinds of language that are here. But in any case, thank you for clarifying.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Reyes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Solicitor General.
Good afternoon, Justice.
Yeah, I am more concerned on the concurring positions on the part of the petitioners and the government through the Office of the Solicitor General about the declaring, in effect declaring the Section 19 of this Act to be unconstitutional. Because to my mind, there are certain expressions which are inherently and fundamentally illegal or immoral. So much so that even the under the international law, there are certain exceptional types of expression that that states are required to prohibit. And these are those which involve child, child pornography, direct and public incitement to commit genocide, advocacy of national, rational, racial, or religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence, and incitement to terrorism. Would not the wholesome invalidation of Section 19 set loose the proliferation of this prohibited expression, Mr. Counsel?
Mr. Justice, our answer to that would be the child pornography law. There is an existing anti-child pornography special law. I think this was passed in 98. 10175 says that if the child pornography is, again, committed through ICT, you step up the penalty one step higher. None of the petitioners have questioned child pornography. Our answer, Your Honor, in relation to 19, which is essentially the takedown provision, is the regime of the Anti-Child Pornography Act of 2009, Your Honor, is something like this. If there is child pornography going on in a site, anybody, a priest, an educator, a teacher, can complain, and the ISP provider has 7 days to take it down. If the ISP provider does not take it down in 7 days, then the ISP provider is at risk for prosecution. Our point, Your Honor, this is the so-called regime of notice and takedown. YouTube, for example, Your Honor, you have heard, if for some reason a private party, his or her picture gets into YouTube or a sex app, you can call YouTube, and they have a choice. They either take it out or they let it remain. If they let it remain, they will be at risk for a damage suit. So that is our point, Your Honor. You don't need a Section 19 takedown provision, and the best evidence is the Anti-Child Pornography Act. That is what the lawyers call, for example, in the United States, the safe harbor. It's a safe harbor for the ISP providers. Because, Your Honor, the reality is the ISPs do not know what is being put through or what goes through their lines. And so the idea and the theory is it is not fair to give liability to the ISPs. Therefore, if the ISPs are notified that there is something there, then the safe harbor is so many days they will decide take down, maintain, and risk. And there is a similar safe harbor provision in the United States Telecommunications Act, Your Honor. Our objection to Section 19 is that, yes, all of those should be taken down, but the experience of the Anti-Child Pornography Act is 7 days is enough to take down, Your Honor. In fact, at the previous argument, phishing is a nefarious activity where, for example, the bank's address is there, and he says, check with your bank, but actually it's not your bank, but it is a malefactor. We understand in the banking industry, the practice is when the bank, which is under attack or is a victim of phishing, is such a victim of phishing, all they have to do is to call the ISP provider and say, sir, I am a victim. And almost immediately we understand the ISP provider will take it down. So my point, there is a natural mechanism which corrects. And the example is YouTube, the example is Google, the example is phishing, and the anti-child pornography. But if you have Section 19, then you have all sorts of problems about it reaching protected speech. And I said, Your Honor, we with all due respect to the Congress, we arrive at the view after much thought that 19 is unconstitutional.
Mr. Counsel, correct me if I'm wrong. One of the prohibited acts in the Anti-Child Pornography Act is luring, which is defined as the act of communicating by means of a computer system. Is it redundant to penalize luring under the cybercrime law when the Anti-Child Pornography Act categorically states that luring can only be committed by means of a computer system?
Well, I can agree to that, Your Honor.
Now, what will be the applicable penalty for the act of luring, considering that the cybercrime law and the Anti-Child Pornography Act declares that it is committed through a computer system? So what will be the extent of the penalty?
I believe, Your Honor, if the luring is done, you know, the conventional way, you lure with a promise, and there is a luring through an internet, through an advertisement, then in that case, the purpose really of Congress is to prosecute this as separate crimes, you know.
So it is no longer distinct and separate from the crime punishable under the revised penal code?
To my mind, Your Honor, it is symptomatic of all of the arguments today. Luring, you can do by physical, you know, you have candy, you have a promise of employment face-to-face. Luring through the internet will be an advertisement that if you take this employment, we will take you to Sabah or where. So the purpose of the law is conventional luring, this is the penalty. But if you use the internet, because conceivably, arguably, your audience, your web, the number of possible victims is bigger, then the state says, I have an interest to punish this with one step, with a penalty one step higher, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Counsel.
Justice Garfield.
Just a clarification, Counsel. I think this was discussed earlier, but I just want to be clarified. In page 96 of your comment, you said Section 6 effectively makes the commission of a crime with the use of ICT a qualifying circumstance. Correct?
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
So it's actually the same offense, only qualified by a circumstance, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if you are convicted of simple rape, you cannot be charged again of qualified rape because the prosecutor said, the victim was a minor. Cannot be done. Double jeopardy, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So here, if you are convicted of staffa, ordinary staffa, but the prosecutor forgot that you actually used your email, can you be charged again with the cybercrime staffa? You are saying it's just a qualifying circumstance. By definition, it's the same offense. There will be double jeopardy.
That would seem to be the case under 10175, Your Honor, because again, in your example, it is a single person, but if you put yourself in the shoes of Congress, I don't believe they were thinking of the single victim. They were thinking of cyber as an opportunity to have a wide number of victims.
There will be more people who will probably know of that libel. But my question is, you are saying it's a qualifying circumstance. And under the law, a qualifying circumstance does not make it a separate offense. It's exactly the same crime. The qualifying circumstance merely creates a higher penalty.
We agree with Your Honor.
So there will be double jeopardy if you say it's a qualifying circumstance. By definition, it's subject to double jeopardy already.
Well, that's why, Your Honor, in fact, we are saying that there can be no double jeopardy in libel, and we gave the example.
No, I'm saying, because you said Section 6 does not apply to libel because there's only a single publication. Okay, let's not talk of libel. Let's talk of staffa, my example, or rape. I mean, if you say qualifying circumstance, by definition, you're saying it's the same offense, only the penalty is higher.
Yes,
so you run into trouble with double jeopardy if you sue, if you prosecute again.
In the case of libel, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, you have basically, of course, understood from the beginning that there are several possibilities here. We uphold the constitutionality of the entire law. We strike down parts of it, or we declare it entirely unconstitutional. And
yes.
This question is important because this is a process that we have to really go through, because we have, to the extent possible, we'll have to try to interpret the law in order to save what can be saved, in order that it can be said to be conformable to the Constitution. But for every one of the sections that has been already described here, you had already constitutional standards, and the questions of the justices were really whether those provisions meet the constitutional standards that have been established by jurisprudence. And so I will now challenge you. Considering the numerous arguments that have gone, especially on the specific provisions that were subject to these arguments, without prejudice to our reading the arguments that have been filed in the petitions, in your consolidated comment, and even in the memoranda that you will be asked to submit to us, can you conceive of a Cybercrime Act, RA 10-175, that will be more conformable to the declaration of policy in Section 2? Because if one reads the declaration of policy of Section 2, it gives the interpretation that really what is being attempted by Congress to be regulated is the use of the ICT infrastructure to wreak industrial havoc and to render the security of data more uncertain. Do you agree that that is the flavor of Section 2?
Yes, Your Honor.
If that is the intention, therefore, of Section 2, and it seems to be a very tightly written section, I will go through Section 3, and I find that so far there could be possibly no problem with Section 3, except when it relates already to the definition of cyber libel. In other words, the problem of publication when the computer system is not connected. But apart from that, the definitions possibly could stand. Possibly.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then you go to Section 4. And when you go to A, there seems to be A1, illegal access, A2, illegal interception, 3, data interference, system interference, and misuse of devices, there seems to be still no incongruity with the intended protection of the technology's use.
Yes, Your Honor.
You go to cyber to paragraph 6, cyber squatting, still, it gives you an idea that basically the intention is to protect the integrity of the infrastructure. But it is when you go basically to content-related offenses that you notice a distinction. Whereas the more technical offenses in cyber crime offenses are quite detailed in their description, all the way from section 4A, A1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and B, computer-related offenses, 1, 2, and 3, all the way to computer-related identity theft. The description of how those acts are being committed are sufficiently technical to give one the impression that there is an intention to be quite precise about the definition of those crimes.
Yes, Your
Okay.
Honor.
Now, however, if you go to content-related offenses and you go to cybersex, and really this is a structural question I'm trying to ask you, considering how 1932, the passage of time since 1932 has seen so many changes in our libel jurisprudence, and the fact that you had only basically a very, very simple sentence here on cyber sex, and with all the complications that have already been raised, even memes and tweets, etc., child pornography even, this seems to be actually something that seems to a cursory reader a forced insertion. What would you say to that?
I would say, Your Honor, that it seems to me this is indicative of the sentiment of the Congress, again, flowing from the same principle that what is a crime in the real world perforce should be a crime in the cyber world. And in fact, that was the theme, Your Honor, in the House, in the sponsorship speech of Congress, of Representative
But you see, if you go Tinga. Upwards and you look at the other cybercrime offenses, the drafter of the law really tried to even examine and define, for example, such a thing as such an act as misuse of devices by really being very careful, precise about it. But you see, this innocuous-looking sentence is the one that has created so much objection from so many petitioners, and the most emotional and vocal of objections. Is it because this really was never intended to be a part of the law as it was originally conceived?
That could be, Your Honor, because the precision in language that flows from the many of the provisions before you go to content is so, Your Honor, because this is patterned after the Budapest Convention. So many of the provisions are lifted, and that is why they're so precise.
So you see, it stands apart. It stands out that C1, C2, and C4 seem to be of a very different nature. The way it was crafted, it seems to have been thrown completely from off left field. And then you go to section 5 and 6, and then 7. The same very complicated questions that have arisen during the entire oral arguments arise. In other words, what was the purpose for increasing the penalty provisions, for saying that that prosecution can be had under the RPC, this law and other special laws? This, considering all the complications, this again seems to be not fit if you are going to contrast this with the definition of penalties, for example, in Section 8. Do you agree with me that there seems to be something wrong with the way this has been written?
Well, that can be a view, Your Honor. And again, I say the reason could be that there was a very good model, the Budapest Convention, And when you go to the content-related crimes, that is where all these sorts of problems
And then we go to Section 12, real-time collection of traffic data, and there is again another problem. We grapple with the question of JUCOS, because this is the first time that we have encountered such an animal, and we don't know who is going to determine or identify what kind of animal JUCOS is. And you even, of course, demonstrated an ease with Section 12, where there is nobody questions the legitimacy of investigation in the context of law enforcement agencies' functions. But the question really was where the standard stood. And that was quite problematic. In other words, my question is this. If you take out those provisions that seem to be ill-fitting, in your candid view, will the Cybercrime Prevention Act still be one integrated law if there is partial striking down of these provisions?
Our answer would be...
Because you had earlier given the statement that Section 12, unless I misunderstood you, is the heart of regulation on hacking. If your position is if Section 12 is struck down, then this entire law is good for nothing. That's quite a strong position to take. Can you respond?
Our answer, Your Honor, is that yes, a position can be taken that the cybercrime law can be legitimized minus the controversial provisions, if you may. But I will plead, Your Honor, that under the concept of separation of powers, there is more than enough evidence in the debates that there was a strong sentiment of the Congress to include in the cybercrime law all of the new content offenses. And in fact, Your Honor, the sentiment of Congress was to wholesale, in one fell swoop, if you may, say anything which is a crime in the RPC is a crime when committed through cyber. And there may be some imprecision, you know, how do you square off penalties? That's why there is some imprecision in the table of penalties. But by and large, my appeal would be it is a strong sentiment of Congress, Your Honor.
Well, we are very, very respectful of the sentiments of Congress. That's why I had to preface my question with the fact that we are forced to go through the exercise of trying to find out what can be saved. But knowing that there are these questions, that many of those provisions do not meet constitutional standards, and knowing that the penal provisions, the existence of the penal provisions, require us to strictly construe all of these statutes in favor of the accused. In other words, because of the nature of what is going to happen if there is an offense found under this, our question is basically, if you are going to take out all those provisions that seem to be not precise sufficiently for the purposes of a definition of a crime and other sundry objections, is it not more, in fact, is it not even more rational to have the laws standing like this without some of the offending provisions that I had cited being there? In other words, you are saying that there is a plea to consider the sentiment of Congress to include the new cyber content offenses such as child pornography, cyber sex, and cyber libel. You earlier also said that Section 12 is at the heart of the prevention of hacking, the effort of the government to prevent hacking. Having made those strong positions, if we strike down Section 12 and cyber sex, cyber libel,
child pornography through the cyber, the use of computers. Will this still pass the test of an integrated and a whole statute? Please be candid with this, because these are quite serious choices that we're going to face soon.
My answer, Your Honor, would be if this honorable court will be minded to arrive at a view that certain content offenses do not pass constitutional muster, then that could be one course of action, Your Honor, because then you will just invite the Congress to come back, if they feel strongly, to come back with you with content offenses more precisely defined. On Section 12, Your Honor, our view would be, if there's anything you want to save, save Section 12, give law enforcement a chance, and let the Congress possibly pass from a strong message from this court to give more what we call robust procedural safeguards, Your Honor.
Now, there was a theory before that was floated that to save Section 12, due cause can have reference to other laws. Is the court allowed to try to find the meaning of due cause in other extant laws?
I would agree, Your Honor. Yes.
What gives you basis to say that? You mean the law enforcement agency will say that in the investigation of whether a crime has been a crime is possibly being committed in this under this particular special penal law or under the RPC article, etc., or under this cybercrime law, we have found due cause. Are we authorized to construe due cause to be referencing to any other extant law outside? Or do we give another, or can we set, the court itself, can it set a standard for the law enforcement agency invoking the power granted it under Section 12?
To my mind, Your Honor, the starting point for due cause will be in the ordinary course of events, assuming good faith and regularity. In our example, due cause is There's a complaint from a citizen that cybercrime has been committed, and that should be enough to trigger.
But it is not there in Section 12. Will this argument of yours, this statement of yours, be included in the police manual, saying before you invoke Section 12, please heed the statement of Soljan Hardilesa that states this? It doesn't state that. So the law enforcement agency will have to live with its definition of due cause. So how do we go about trying to be very cognizant and respectful of Congress and not be concerned about protecting the rights of our citizens, because we might ourselves find the standard for due cause absent?
Well, Your Honor, it has been publicized that as a starting point, law enforcement could start with their internal rules, you know, on the meaning of due cause, and that would, to a certain extent, canalize the exercise of discretion as a starting point, Your Honor.
So I have no further question. You understand the exercise we're going through. Justice Carpio seems to still have one question, but then we also have to find out if Justice Leonen will proceed with your clarificatory question to the prosecutor. So Justice Carpio, then Justice Abad.
Counsel, even without Section 12, we have a law punishing hacking, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Section 32A of the Electronic Commerce Act.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not a problem. Even if this law is declared void, hackers will still be penalized. Okay. Your problem is how to collect traffic data. but you just go to court, get a search warrant, you'll collect everything. What's so problematic about that? It will not stop the law enforcers from going after hackers. There's a law punishing hacking, and you can go to the judge, get a search warrant. People who are enforcing intellectual property rights do that all of the time. They go to the judge, get a search warrant. So why do law enforcers want to do a shortcut? They want to do it themselves, decide for themselves to get material that refers to the private life of citizens. So I don't think it will hamper law enforcement. You can always go to the judge. And there's always that Electronic Commerce Act that penalizes hacking. Okay, thank you.
On the cyber sex provision, it says that the law punishes willful engaging in lascivious exhibition of sexual organs or sexual activity with the aid of a computer system for favor or for consideration. While consideration has long been interpreted by this court, favor has not. No? Do you agree?
Yes, Your Honor.
So under the rules of construction, if we are to give the word favor its ordinary meaning, that would be the dictionary meaning, which is the repository of commonly accepted meanings. Is that right?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Well, favor is defined in the dictionary as an attitude of approval or liking or friendly regard shown toward another, especially by a superior. So when a person sends a prohibited picture of sexual organs or sexual activity to a friend to get an attitude of approval from such friend, the sender would be criminally liable for cybercrime.
Our respectful answer is no, Your Honor. No. The answer is no.
You would not be liable?
No.
Well, but that is under the definition of favor, engaging in the exhibition of a prohibited sex material using the internet.
As I said, Your Honor, and again, we are disputing on language, the intent of cyber sex is cyber prostitution, Your Honor, not a private exchange of...
But I do not find in that definition of cyber sex the word prostitution or trafficking in sex. So there's nothing there. It's just something that you are suggesting as the actual application of this rule.
We agree, Your Honor.
Only to those activities, but the law doesn't say that. That's the problem.
We agree, Your Honor, but when we went to the legislative debates, the clear intent was to curb cyber prostitution. And again, if you match the language, this language is almost lifted from 341. But of course, it contains, I concede, Your Honor, it contains some language from 201, you know, on lascivious, as in, I think 201 talks of lewd. So, but I hear the argument, Your Honor.
So, so adults, it's possible adults could be sent to jail for privately sharing obscene pictures with fellow adults for favor, because that's what the law says, favor. And as you said, that's... It is a dictionary meaning.
Again, Your Honor, an indictment can be constructed along those lines. I agree. All I'm saying is that is not the intent of the law, Your Honor.
Well, that's not the intent, but it's not clearly stated in the law. Anyway, the Section 12, the Chief Justice is saying that Section 12 is about, is a tool for... running after hackers, but the Section 12 states that it will be used solely for tracking and prosecuting hackers?
It does not on its face.
So actually, as written, it can apply to other criminal activities.
Even
non-criminal activities. There's no need for what you call that. It's just a reasonable belief, according to you, that will be the basis for it. So, well, anyway, does this allow the police to set up and attach electronic equipment to the equipment that the service providers use for handling traffic data?
No, sir.
They have to rely on the service provider to give them access?
Yes, Your Honor.
Without using their own facilities. And so, you said that in the United States, this kind of authority is given only to federal officers.
That's what you said.
Why do you think that this authority was given to federal officers and not to ordinary policemen?
The federal officers are the so-called United States attorneys, Your Honor. They are lawyers of...
FBI, you know? You're referring to FBI here. Federal...
No, sir. I think they refer to United States attorneys who are lawyers of the American Department of Justice. The rationale, Your Honor, is these are lawyers, and if they misrepresent the facts on which they act, there is recourse against them. Among others, there are lawyers, there is disbarment, there is...
But this law did not take that kind of precaution that it should be a power to be handled only by properly trained lawyers of the national government. No? It does not take that precaution. It gives this power to any kind of law enforcer.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So, now... If this is to be real-time collection of traffic data, does this mean a random collection of data without the police having any idea as to the identity of the sender or the receiver of the messages?
No, sir. Real-time...
So is it random or not random?
They're not blind.
As if in the highway, you know? You stop at random, the checkpoint, you stop at random any vehicle.
No, sir, this is not...
It has to be based on some reason.
Yes, Your
Honor. That is the case, if it is targeted to a particular person, a sender or receiver, on the basis of some reasonable belief that that sender or receiver involved some crime, then there is no reason why the police officer should not apply for search warrant on the basis of the information that it has, and not conduct a real-time, they choose anybody, they can do it to anybody.
The example, Your Honor, cited by law enforcement is a kidnapping in progress. That is an exigent circumstance where you may need real-time collection of traffic data.
Real time as it is going on, you are getting the data. That's what I mean. It's really, as I said, the traffic in EDSA, in real time, they're passing like that. Then you pick on anyone, and then you check it.
If I may, Your Honor.
This is what it is.
Real time is not randomness. Real time is about, quick time, but not randomness. So there has to be, in my example, there was a break-in.
No, that's why if it's not random, you have some basis for targeting. Because you say it's not random, then therefore it is targeted. Is it targeted or not? Is this real time collection of data a targeted exercise?
It is not targeted in the sense that there is discretion. It is up to the policeman to target. It is targeted in the sense that if there is a crime... Again, I go back to my example. If there is a hacking, if there is a kidnapping, then in that sense, it is targeted to that particular set of facts. You need to know, in the case of the hacker, trace back his IP address. In the case of an ongoing kidnapping, you may need in real time to know where this cell phone is calling from, where is it, location data, and then law enforcement will triangulate and try to pin down the kidnappers.
What assurance can you give us that a police officer is going to use this authority for real time traffic data collection for a valid purpose, for a real good purpose, and not misuse it? What assurance can you give us?
Well, not personal, Your Honor. The answer will be
none. Well, you cannot give us any assurance.
Can I answer, Your Honor? The answer would be regularity of the discharge of function. The answer would be the possibility of abuse is never a reason not to have a regulatory regime in
like
the first place.
Like that ambush in Calamba, regularity of performance of official duty.
That is as far as I can argue, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just a clarification, because we are trying to understand really what you're saying about Section 12. In Section 10, you are already, the law is already creating a cybercrime unit or center manned by special investigators to exclusively handle cases involving violations of this act. Now, does this act talk about investigators who will also have a defensive role instead of just investigating crimes as they are reported?
For example, Your Honor, the National Bureau of Investigation has an existing cybercrime unit, and they investigate crimes as reported.
As reported.
Yes,
in
Your
other
Honor.
Words, when you talk about monitoring of real-time traffic data, you don't have them as if they're listening to all channels, no? Finding out where the movements are coming from. Or do they simulate a defensive unit that will prevent hacking for example, important websites? Would you have that? They are already tracking traffic even though there is no reported crime, simply because they are going to say that this is JUCOS. JUCOS includes preventive monitoring. So JUCOS can include preventive monitoring?
My understanding from our interviews is yes, Your Honor. I understand, for example, the National Bureau of Investigation has working relationships with foreign law enforcement units, like, for example, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So out of this cooperation, sometimes my understanding is they will be warned that you are going to be subject of a cyber attack, and they brace for it, Your Honor. But my understanding is largely the function will be a crime is committed, and then they will come in and investigate. But
largely, that's largely.
From my impression, Your Honor. But I think the answer is, do we have like a national security agency with full-time license?
So that concept actually can give really rise to the fear of Big Brother. In other words, there is constant surveillance, because you're basically saying even preventive monitoring is conceivable under Section 10. Now, if you relate that to Section 12, then the fears and the dangers even increase in the minds of our citizens. And so far, our reading of the law, we've been trying to look for the safeguards. You've been talking about safeguards that may exist in other extant laws, but we cannot find them here. Solicitor General, so the court has a problem in its hands, and you can never appreciate the kind of scenarios that we are already anticipating.
Okay. We understand, Your Honor.
Okay. So I understand, and of course, this comment, when I was trying to give you the benefit of your argument, I was really trying to confine the issue to prevention of hacking or the tracing of hacking. But Justice Abad is really correct. The Section 12 basically can embrace any kind of concern presently worded.
In the sense, Your Honor, that yes, indeed, if a police officer will misuse 12,
yes,
absolutely there is no crime going on. He'll use it to harass. That can happen, Your Honor. But again, that is an abuse which I will argue is not an argument why the regulatory regime would not be put in the first place. There are remedies for abuse, Your Honor.
Okay. I have no further question unless Justice Leonen would like to still go ahead with his clarificatories.
Chief, just maybe for the memoranda, perhaps number one, if I may request that if there is any of the petitioners using their status as legislator as standing, that they also indicate their vote in terms of the law in the legislature. And I think this refers to Senator Gingona and Bayan Muna, if they're being represented also by the Council for Bayan. Also, if I may request that perhaps just to give us an idea of the technical aspects here, that the example of a hacker, a phishing experience, and a malware like a virus, what is the investigative procedure that is envisioned by both the petitioner and the respondent, even as an annex, just so we can go through the technical details. More precisely, for instance, whether data capture can be filtered and that data capture filtering can be monitored.
Yes. This is De Castro.
Just one clarification. Will Section 13 now require all service providers to preserve traffic data and subscriber information for a period of 6 months?
Yes, Your Honor.
That will be their duty.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I may, Your Honor, the rationale is that because of cyber crimes, the law enforcement authorities would want the providers to keep records at least for 6 months. And this triggered a debate because if you ask for 6 months, then that takes up storage space. And the banks gave their comments, and this was a compromise, Your Honor. There were people who thought 12 months, and they arrived at 6 months as a commercially acceptable a compromise. But if you'll notice, Your Honor, if there is already triggered criminal investigation, the 6 months is not applicable. The provider is supposed to keep it until further notice from the courts or the authorities.
Section 14, regarding the disclosure of computer data, there is here the provision is that law enforcement authorities shall issue an order requiring a person, etc., and that is after the issuance of a court warrant. Do
yes,
I take
Your
it
Honor.
That the order to be issued by law enforcement authorities should conform closely to the court warrant to be issued?
Yes, Your Honor.
So they cannot deviate from that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Justice Leonen, just to clarify, you're just asking a manifestation on the vote by the legislators who are petitioners here, or would you like a statement on why legislators come here?
Just the vote.
The petitioners' councils are hereby advised to include that in your memorandum. I would like to also ask the petitioner, especially Attorney Dicini, to include a portion regarding the possible in the cyber world, the legitimate collection of data. The safeguards that you had already conceded could be really existing in the cyber world. Because if I remember right, your argument was due cause is the one that is really problematic here. So with that, the Solicitor General is hereby discharged, and we will give the parties 20 days. 20 days, Justice Abad, to come up with the filing of their simultaneous memoranda. 20 days from today, Justice Garten.
May I know if the parties, any of the petitioners, have amended their petition?
We have amended, Your Honor.
originally we have amended our
petition. Attorney Roque, yes.
And we will also second file amendment. A second amendment.
Okay, again, you have already amended it once. You
yes,
are
Your Honor.
Going to file your second amendment?
Yes, Your Honor.
When are you going to file your second amendment? Because the Solicitor General must first see your amended petition before he can respond.
Yes, Madam. Tomorrow, Your Honor.
Okay. The Attorney Harry Roque is hereby given a non-extendable period of 1 day in order to file his second amended petition. From which point, upon receipt, you make sure that the Solicitor General receives it personally. And from tomorrow, we will then count the 20-day period, non-extendable on the part of everyone. Okay. There being no further question or clarification from any of my colleagues, Attorney Cruz?
Just for the record, Your Honor, we've noted that the temporary restraining order issued by the court, based on our count, will lapse by next week. And if we may be informed if there has been a ruling already.
We will be addressing that in due time. That is something that will come in a timely manner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. The response on the motion to the motion for extension. There being no further question or clarification, the session is hereby adjourned.